Tonight on Arena, Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser with their best picks of the Christmas TV scheduled, and Doreena Clancy on her documentary about the Cork brothers who matched the Lumières in France. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Now, I'm giving you a warning. You might want to get a pen or a pencil and your copy of the RTE guide and pay close attention to the radio. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser are with me this evening with their pick of the festive telly, and quite a set of picks they have. They've been very greedy, in fact. They want everything this Christmas. But you better be on the good list, I'm telling you. Christmas favourites like Wallace and Gromit will feature, to the return of Gavin and Stacey back again for another final programme, to a documentary about the Queen of Pop herself. We have you covered for all your small screen needs. So as I said, pen and pencil. And for the very, very organised among you, highlighters, please, in front of your RTE guide. We'll start with our own Ina Hardwick, who stars in a Christmassy chiller on the BBC. And did I say Chris Wasser and Jenny Gannon are here? Well, I'm saying it now if I didn't. This kind of ghost story at Christmas, well, of course, A Christmas Carol is precisely that. But yeah, the ghost story at Christmas has been going on the BBC for a while now.
It has, yeah. Started off in the 1970s, ran for a couple of decades. Mark Gatiss, the actor, comedian, filmmaker, who is a perfect choice for this, he took it up there a few years ago, and I think this is his sixth version of the Christmas ghost story. We actually talked about the lot number 249 on Arena this time last year. The Arthur Conan Doyle story. Yeah, Kit Harington was in it. And I thought they did a great job with that last year. They're these little half hour, like they are horror stories, but there's a light comic touch to it as well. And they're intentionally silly and, you know, they're quite old school. But this year...
Ina Hardwick. Yeah.
This year, Ina Hardwick is the lead in this. So, and Ina's going to have he's having a good Christmas in the ghost story. He's going to have a great 2025 playing Roy Keane, but we'll come back to that. But this is Ian Nesbitt's unsettling short story, Man Size in Marble, which has been renamed Woman in Stone. And it tells of a couple from London. We have Ina Hardwick and Phoebe Horn. They do not have the best marriage, and they think that maybe, and it's all because of him, because he is quite abusive.
He's an obnoxious artist.
Oh, he's the worst.
Does such a thing exist?
He is the worst, and she's a writer, but she can't get a word in when she's around him, and he's constantly referring to her as wifey. They move to a countryside village. They think this is going to be the fresh start. They hire someone to cook and clean the house. Monica Dolan is playing this character, and she tells them that, have you been to the church? Have you seen the effigies of the marble knights? Well, on Christmas Eve, they're going to come to life, and they're going to come to this house. Now, everyone in the village thinks, well, this is just a story, but unfortunately, Ina Hardwick is going to figure out for himself that there might be actually truth in this.
Oh, and there's a housekeeper here. How scary,
Monica
is she?
Dolan. Yeah, she's actually the best, because sometimes like these things, like they're ghost stories, but they're not that scary. But I'm telling you, when Monica Dolan is telling the story about the Marble Knights, you know she should be telling every horror story for the BBC.
All right,
Ina Hardwick is quite good in this. It's half an hour long. You can't really go wrong with it.
And as you say, we'll be looking forward to him as Roy Keane in 2025. A ghost story for Christmas, Woman of Stone, BBC Two, Christmas Eve, 10:15 p.m. That's what you'll need to be writing down, because you'll forget it all. Christmas Eve, 10:15 p.m. The Woman of Stone. Let's move on to Becoming. Jen didn't see that, and you have, I think, been looking, Jen, at Becoming Madonna. Will we have a little listen to what she says in the trailer to this, which kind of is 32 seconds of highlights from Madonna's life.
I have to say hi. This is Madonna. I came here with $35 in my pocket. It was the bravest thing I've ever done. And I've always felt like such an outsider, like I could never fit in. Come here, brother. This is my brother, Christopher.
She was our mother's namesake. It either crushes you or elevates you.
Becoming Madonna is the documentary we're talking about now. It's on Sky Documentaries and Now TV from Monday, December the 30th. So it's a series that we're talking about here, Jen. From what I hear, obviously I'm only listening to 32 seconds. We're getting a lot of stuff that we've heard before, but there's a particular lens you're saying here, yeah?
It's an hour and a half documentary.
So it's an hour and a half.
But it's not the whole story. So it's one. Who could condense the whole story of Madonna to that. But it's one that moves from her early days in New York, as we know, that apocryphal tale of her landing in, you know, Times Square with $35 in her pocket and saying, where do I go? And then right up to the Sex Book and the Erotica album. So you're ending 1992, 93. So, I mean...
The real focus here, though, is the AIDS epidemic.
It is. There's
and
this
her activism in that area.
It really is. It's a really interesting LGBTQ lens on who Madonna was and what she meant. It details, you know, her dance teacher was a great mentor to her, a man who saw her charisma from the very beginning. Her friendship with Martin Burgoyne, who opened her life to the fashion and art and, you know, the underground scene of New York at that time, the gay scene in New York at that time, and her friendship with, you know, Keith Haring as well. And there is this assertion that some of her creativity, her creative bravery from like that stunning 1984 performance of Like a Virgin on the MTV Awards, where, you know, she humped the stage in a wedding dress, and to the publication of the Sex Book, was partly due to the influence of that boundary pushing that she saw in that community. And there's also this sense of, you know, what Madonna was doing culturally, holding this magnifying glass up to the hypocrisy of America, drawing out all those insecurities about, you know, the very name Madonna, like, what does that mean? And I'm like, she found herself like slap bang in the middle of controversy all the time.
And constantly controversial. You mentioned, as we were listening to the clip there, about the brother Chris, who died recently,
yeah, which is extremely sad. Such, he was a dancer on her tours. You would have seen him in bed with Madonna, or Truth or Dare, as it's called. He's such a massive influence on her life, and they had an intense but kind of sparky relationship to the end, I'd say. But it's really about, this whole documentary is about her unwillingness to conform, unwillingness to dumb herself down or to be silenced. And that
is it mostly archival material?
It is all archival material, which some of it is absolutely gorgeous behind the scene footage that you may not have seen. But like, it is about how, I would say that maybe Gen Z might not know the Madonna that is here, might not know what an important figure she was at that time. And it needs to be said, especially because these days when you see pop stars not acting, you know, they're acting extremely mealy-mouthed when it comes to politics or avoiding social commentary at all. And, you know, because they're thinking about the bottom line all the time. Yeah. And she, you know, it makes me proud of Madonna all the time, for she always took a stand and didn't care about the consequences. And this definitely hammers that home.
Shows that. Becoming Madonna is the title of the hour and a half long, I misled you there. It's on Sky Documentaries Now TV on Monday, December the 30th. Oh, this is the first of these now, Chris. This Gavin and Stacey.
Yeah.
The final programme.
Yeah. Yeah, they're setting themselves up for embarrassment. Yeah. James Corden and Rue Jones here, because I was thinking to myself, how many times can you actually finish a sitcom? Because Gavin and Stacey ended in 2010.
Well, let's listen to the end. Yeah. The end of it in 2010. Of course, James Corden and Ruth, what's her second name? Wilson?
Ruth Jones.
Beg your pardon. Wilson Jones. Jones. Ruth Jones.
I loves you. With all my heart. So, will you marry me?
What?
Marry me.
There you go, Smithy and Nessa, Ruth Jones and James Corden. That, in fact, wasn't the 2011 ending that you were speaking.
That was the 2019 one.
That was the kind of, that was the reboot after the last time it ended.
Yeah.
But is it really going to end this time then?
Well, I was saying
where
that.
Where are we?
I feel like they've set themselves up for embarrassment, because if they're going to continue it in another 5 years or another 10 years, I don't know what they're going to call it, because they've called this one, Gavin and Stacey, the finale. But Ruth Jones and James Corden have decided that there is potentially a film in this, because that's exactly what this is. It's an extension. It's a 90-minute feature to sort of wrap up any sort of loose ends. The big one being that, you know, Nessa proposed to Smithy in the 2019 Christmas special. So we'll pick up 5 years later. We'll see what actually happened there. We'll check in on obviously Gavin and Stacey's marriage, and the BBC synopsis promises that you know they're looking for ways to spice up their marriage after being together that long. Basically, we're going to see Nessa start a new business. We're going to see obviously Nessa and Smithy have a kid, and then he's going to be getting an apprenticeship with his father. Everyone is in there. They've even said there was always this long running joke in the series that, you know, there was this fishing trip that one of the characters was on with his nephew, and something happened on this fishing trip, and maybe they're finally going to tell us what happened. unfortunately, my thought going into this, and I haven't seen it yet, is not every gap needs to be filled. I'm not sure we'd need all of those things wrapped up. And the beauty of Gavin Stacey was that, you know, it was great in small doses. It was a half hour sitcom.
Short episodes,
you know, so 90 minutes is a bit too much for a sitcom. And also, in the 5 years since we've last had Gavin and Stacey, the charm has worn off James Corden a little bit.
Where was the charm with James Corden to begin with?
I have heard very strong opinions expressed about James Corden. Is it Marmite or just
oh no? It's not Marmite. It's whatever. It's Black Death. It's poison for me, like poison. But you know, I do find with Smithy, he's bearable as that character. He's bearable, but I think
arguing that he can act.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then, I suppose, for him. But I think with something like Gavin and Stacey, with a lot of sitcoms, it's all about the subsidiary characters. And someone like Rob Brydon's Bryn, I mean, we want to see him back. We want to see Pam, like Alison Steadman, and like even Larry Lamb as Mick. He's going to be retired, so he's going to be hanging around the house a lot more, or playing a lot more golf, apparently.
So when you mentioned those characters, I kind of go, oh, I'd love to see I don't know if I want 90 minutes of it.
No, but I think like what they're maybe trying to do, if this is the finale, is not to do a royal family on it, or not to do an Only Fools and Horses on it, where you keep on bringing these characters back and maybe overstaying their welcome after, you know, a long time. I think with the royal family, they managed to get away with it because of the peerless writing. But I do think maybe this is the end, because if you're stretching it out for this long, how can you come back from that?
Christmas Day, 9 p.m. if you're still awake after the dinner. That's on BBC. BBC One, Gavin and Stacey, the finale, perhaps.
Question mark.
Exactly. Let us move on then. Now, I should point out that for most of these, for all of these, in fact, we are in preview mode. So we're not telling you whether they're good or bad. We're just saying, here's what we're expecting type of thing. So Squid Game Season 2 on Netflix on December the 26th. I have a vague memory that when season one ended, which is quite a while ago now, they were already talking about season two. It's taken a while for it to get to us, Chris.
Well, Netflix was talking about season two, but Huang Dong Ku, I think I have his name right, apologies, the creator of the show, never envisioned a second season. And he said that from the beginning, that, you know, it wasn't just a one and done, but it took so long for this show to be picked up, because he had initially written it like 10, maybe 15 years beforehand. But you know, the series was immensely popular. It was nominated for 14 Primetime Emmy Awards. It still is, after 3 years, the most watched show on Netflix by some distance. So obviously the people in charge wanted the second series, and it's taken an awful long time to get here. But this is the first part. There's going to be a third one as well. So this story,
so we know there are going to be three seasons.
It's going to be told in three chapters. And it's basically, you know, there's not an awful lot we can say, but again, we are in preview mode. But it is still going to follow the main character, player 456, Seong Gi-hun, played brilliantly by Lee Jung-jae in the first season. And we know that he was this cash-strapped stranger who was down his luck, broke, lonely, depressed, an awful lot like all the other contenders in the games. They're approached by this recruiter, this slippery salesman. He takes them off to an island arena, and they all basically battle one another to the death.
Yeah, but that...
For money.
Like, season one, the brilliance of it was when we all realised, oh, these people are all going to be... We'll get to know them, and then they're going to be annihilated, and one person will be left standing, and they will be the winner of the money. I'm not sure how you can follow on with that. You can't do the same thing again.
A murderous crystal maze was kind of how I was describing it when it first happened. But I think what this is kind of getting into who is behind Squid Game.
All right,
and and he's trying to seek revenge by going back into the game to find out who these people are in control and, you know, seek revenge on them. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just worried we are like getting the creator of Squid Game into his own never-ending dystopian game by watching it, because he'll have to keep on making more of them.
We know that season two is going to be on Netflix from December the 26th. Season three, I presume, will be along at some later date. Even when I say the title of this, I have to smile. Wallace and Gromit, Vengeance Most Foul, which is on BBC One on Christmas Day at 6:10, when I will still be awake after the dinner. Mightn't be awake at 9 o'clock.
I mean, it's been 16 years since we've had a proper Wallace and Gromit.
I can't believe it's that long.
And also, one of the best villains of all time is back after 20 years, Feathers McGraw. So he's like the BDI master of disguise penguin. So he's returned. And this time around, it has a story to it. It's touching on our own very, very real fears about AI. So Wallace has a new smart gnome robot called Norbert, and it's voiced by Rhys Shearsmith from League of Gentlemen. So that, you know, you can tell the tone there. So he's helping him around the house and the garden. And, you know, it's just, he becomes more, Wallace is becoming more and more infatuated by, you know, how great this robot is and everything it can do. And obviously Gromit is feeling very isolated as, you know, his right-hand man. And but then one day Norbot seems to have developed a mind of his own. And is he being controlled by Feathers McGraw? And what havoc is going to happen?
Feathers McGraw is back, yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, Norbit is not just putting on another brew or getting some Wensleydale from the fridge. There's other things happening here. So, I mean, it's just gorgeously put together. It's beautiful. It's warm. Yeah. It's, you know, Aardman animation, like, at its finest. Like, you can't resist it. It's irresistible.
Though, we have no Peter Salas as the voice of Wallace. What a replacement that they had to find there. Who is doing it?
Ben Whitehead has been an Aardman favourite for years now, and also he had voiced Wallace in various tie-ins. Video games, sat-nav, advertisements, everything.
So you know, it will sound the same. It's the same character,
absolutely,
is it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's a lovely tribute of a performance, basically.
Because Peter Salas obviously created the voice, and what Ben Whitehead is doing is recreating the voice that somebody else did.
Yeah, and I think at one stage Peter Salas had said, look, after I'm gone, it would be lovely if they did carry on. And I'm glad they did, because I have seen this and it's just ingenious. It's thrilling. It's very, very funny, very sweet. I would watch a whole, it's 76 minutes long, and I would actually watch 76 minutes of just Feathers McGraw hanging out in the cell, because that stuff is just fantastic.
All right. That's, what did I say? 6:10, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
On BBC One on Christmas Day itself. I have to say, I'm just looking at the clip in front of me on the computer screen here, and I'm already laughing. Kunk on Life. For those who don't know who this wonderful reporter Kunk is, maybe you would explain Diana Morgan's character.
Diane Morgan's creation, Philomena Kunk, she first appeared on her screen. She initially came out of Charlie Brooker's show Screen Wipe, which would do an end of year review, and she was like a talking head on that show. She was this terrible documentarian, and it kind of started out as Diane Morgan lampooning those ill-equipped celebrities that kind of, you know, try their hand at investigative reporting. They all wanted to be Louis Theroux at one point, and they were just not up to the job. And so they were completely out of their depth, and so is Kunk. And she's now a proper comic character in her own right, up like with that kind of Alan Partridge cringe-worthy comedy where you're dying inside watching her talk to these academics and ask the most crazy banal questions and watch their faces
drop.
Here
she is. Here's Philomena setting up what the documentary is about. And she's walking through some amazing landscapes as she's doing this. I don't know if it's AI generated or whatever, but there was big budget spent on that, on those landscapes, that's for sure.
Have you ever looked around at the limitless majesty of creation and wondered what all these forests, valleys, mountains and puddles are actually for? Wondered how many buildings were knocked down to make way for them and who granted the planning permission? Wondered about all the incredible yet musky animals we share our planet with. What's up with them? From pointless ants to long-necked horse monsters, from repugnant wombats to beautiful elephants. What do the creatures want? And why do they refuse to tell us?
That's it. Diane Morgan as Philomena Kunk, which will be on BBC Two on December the 30th. It's the deadpanness with which she delivers this. I mean, she's deadly serious when she asks the experts their various questions.
Oh, it's a fantastic performance. I was going to say performance. It is a performance. And also, it's kind of one of those, I feel like to come away from a show like Scream Wipe and get your own series, you're worried because you think, oh, is this thing better in small doses? But actually, no, every special has been brilliant. And also, Diane Morgan plays an investigative reporter in the Wallace and Gromit film called On Your Doorstep. So it's worth it. So we're getting some great Diane Morgan content this Christmas.
And she is the kind of philosopher that you want over Christmas.
Yeah. All right. I do have to say my favourite moment is when she asks Brian Cox which of his names does he prefer. The quick-witted among you can work that out for yourself. Kunk on Life is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. on December the 30th. The Traitors, season three. I think it's not really that you're excited about this on January the 1st on BBC One. I think you're excited about the Irish version of Traitors, really. The Traitors, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'm someone that's never watched this.
Oh, yes, Jen. Jen can give us the basic addict.
And like this, I mean, I think it was a stroke of genius to have Siobhan McSweeney now host our own version of Traitors.
But that's not what we're seeing on January the 1st. Let us hasten to add.
No, it's good time for people to get in on the OG Traitors if they want to start. So
Traitors
on BBC. So with the great Claudia Winkleman as the presenter, with her beautiful shiny fringe and her gorgeous selection of knitwear. This was this unexpected phenomenon when it happened, when it first was on in 2021, I think. And it's based on the popular game Murder or Mafia. Very simple game where a group of...
Children's game you did. We played it at home where one of you is the murderer and you go around and you murder everybody and don't get caught.
And you're split up into the traitors and the faithful. And then they have to discover which one is which and then banish the traitors. Vote them out and win the grand prize. So it's very simple, but it's deliciously tricky. There's contestants are forming alliances, deceiving each other. It's reality TV at its most cunning.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily, I think the argument would go here, it's not necessarily wannabes trying to get a career for themselves. They just want to win the money at the end of the series.
I feel like there's one show or film every year that you're on the outside of and everyone's talking about raving about, and The Traitors was mine last year, so I will rectify that this year. I didn't even know what the rules were about. But there is an Irish version coming later in 2025 that will be hosted by Siobhan McSweeney because apparently the host is the most important part.
They are, but also I think what is really important is the casting, because as you said, they're not your usual pack of, you know, fame-hungry influencers, wannabes. It's people from all walks of life, all ages, all interests. Like Diane last year on the BBC show, she became this star, breakout star, and she's like this middle-aged woman, like, and she was just so thrilling
ages,
to watch.
All types across all careers and all types of things. So get into the mood for Siobhan McSweeney by watching season three, which starts on BBC One on New Year's Day, 8 p.m. SAS Rogue Heroes. Oh, I'm just going to play a clip of this. It's about the SAS, in case you can't work it out.
We are not the same as any unit in the British Army.
Soldiers of the Special Air Service, you have a very early day tomorrow. And you have a war to win.
I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bill Sterling, David Sterling's older brother.
Your commanding officer
sends his warmest regards from prisoner of war camp.
Please have the dog removed.
Do you want all the dogs in here removed, sir? Because there are 35 of us.
James Nesbitt with the joke at the end there of that clip from SAS Rogue Heroes season 2, BBC One, again January the 1st, straight after The Traitors.
Do a double bill.
Will you be doing the double bill on this one, Jenna? Are you a fan?
It's Stephen Knight, so it's Peaky Blinders. So it's what if, like, you know, Peaky Blinders was in World War II, is basically what you're kind of getting here. It's very swarthy. It's very lads running around sweating in the desert. The first season was desert based. Now we're kind of moving into Europe and we're in Sicily, they're going to Italian mainland and it's, I mean, look, I think it's a showcase for the young actors that are in it.
It actually was Jack O'Connell at the
Jack
end.
O'Connell,
I was making James Nesbitt
up
from something else that I've skipped
Jack
past.
Jack O'Connell's a great actor, and I do think he's an actor that is struggling to find a really good role. And I don't exactly know if this is it, but I like people paying attention to him because I think he's a good actor.
Is it a drama or is it... Funny.
It's a Stephen Knight production. Yeah, that's everything you need to know is in that sentence. Yeah,
so there's no irony in any of the bombast that we
No, but it is based on a book by Ben McIntyre. And looks like some historians have come forward to argue about the historical accuracies, but arguing about the historical accuracies with a Stephen Knight production is kind of useless.
It's a moot point.
I feel as though he's maybe stretched himself a little too far. I mean, obviously, he's got the Peaky Blinders film. He had his show about the punk band in Bristol last year. He's got a Victoria and boxing drama also coming in 2025. There's a bit too much Stephen Knight, but it's got a great cast. Connor Swindles is in there too, Sophia Boutella, Dominic West. They're great actors. I just don't know if this is the right show for them.
All right. BBC One, what did they say?
It's January 1st, 9 p.m.
January 1st, 9 p.m. I'm kind of in two minds about this as a kind of a Christmas view, because it's such a serious topic. Lockerbie, A Search for the Truth. It's a drama. This is a drama series as opposed to a documentary on Sky Atlantic starting on January the 2nd. prestige drama is what you're talking about here, Jen, but it's obviously a very serious topic.
It is, and it's Colin Firth, and, you know, I mean, that's, you're getting
playing,
that gravitas.
He's playing the real life
Dr. Jim Sawyer,
whose daughter died in the tragedy.
Exactly, and he was nominated as the spokesperson, you know, for the UK families who were, you know, united trying to get truth and justice out of this. And I do think sometimes when we're looking at these kind of things where you have these adaptations, dramatizations of real stories, it does feel like maybe you should just be watching a documentary if they're not going to do something. Now, we don't know. We haven't seen it yet, obviously. But sometimes I do think, what is the point to this unless there's going to be something about the way it's shot, about the way it's directed, or, you know, about the way it's presented to us. But I mean, I do think it is a story that maybe it might arouse interest in more people that hadn't heard about it before. So.
And I guess the other thing is, Chris, we might get more of the stories of those, of the people who died, the victims who died.
Potentially. Because that's something that Jim Sawyer dedicated his life to and ended up writing a book about, you know, trying to find the truth and the justice here for his daughter Flora, alongside, you know, dozens, hundreds of other people who lost relatives that day. It is directed by Otto Bathurst, who has worked on Peaky Blinders before. Yeah. So I am worried that there might be a little bit of a flashy element to it, because I don't think that story needs it.
Colin Firth is such an amazing player of, you know, nothing.
That's true.
He makes it look as if he's doing nothing. He's doing everything.
Yeah, I think this will be one that where everyone is tuning in for his performance. Yeah. And it's a limited series too. I think there's only going to be 5 episodes, so it won't be too drawn out.
All right, and it starts on Sky Atlantic on January the 2nd. And a little mention for the Hairy Bikers, You'll Never Ride Alone, BBC Two, December the 23rd. That's a Monday, isn't it? At 9 p.m. Obviously, this is going to be all about Dave Myers, and we will just cry.
I've seen it, and it is genuinely lovely. It's basically just a chance for Cy, Simon King, the other half of the Hairy Bikers, to pay tribute alongside Dave Myers' widow Lily to the motorcyclist, food enthusiast, who spent basically 20 odd years travelling the world with his best mate, sampling the local cuisines and just riding through deserts and fields on their bikes together. And also, it takes a look at the fact that earlier this year they had themselves what they call the Dave Day, where they decided to do this.
Oh, that was gorgeous, wasn't it?
It was. It was very well done. They're actually thinking about doing it again next year, where for one day they decided to have this epic tribute ride from the centre of London to Cumbria, to where Dave Myers was from, and 20,000 motorcyclists joined them at various points along the way. So we see that ride and how that was all came together apparently at the funeral during a drunken conversation, and we sit down with Cy and with Lily, and they basically remember the man that was
Dave
Myers.
I hope we get a couple of recipes too.
there's a few things in there.
But it's a lovely tribute to, you know, their brotherhood and celebrating kind of male friendships, and also just the unexpected sensation that
they became,
the cultural phenomenon that they became, which you can never attribute or account for these things.
Yeah, at BBC Two, Monday, December the 23rd at 9 p.m. Do you two now take a holiday from watching television
over
Christmas? Never. No such thing.
Okay. Well, have a good Christmas and hope you get to watch some new stuff that you haven't already had to think about. That's Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. All of their TV reviews for this year. Look forward to talking to them again in 2025. Now, if you didn't get a pencil and you didn't get a pen, don't be giving out to me. I mentioned it at the top, but you would have an opportunity to listen back. It won't be there just yet, but it'll be up on the RTE radio player fairly quickly after the programme tonight, or certainly there by tomorrow, so you can listen back and find out the dates and times of the ones you really want to pencil down for yourself. Now, we have a competition for you tonight and a lovely prize to get you over the January blues. The new film, A Real Pain, opens in Irish cinemas on Wednesday the 8th of January. The film stars Jesse Eisenberg and Kieran Culkin as first cousins David and Benji, who go on a tour through Poland to honour their beloved grandmother. The film was written and directed by Jesse Eisenberg, and there is real Oscar buzz around Succession star Kieran Culkin for his work in the film. Our prize is 2 tickets to the Irish premiere of A Real Pain. It takes place at the Lighthouse Cinema in Smithfield on Tuesday, January the 7th, 6:30 p.m. And we have an overnight stay in a nearby hotel in Smithfield, so you won't have too far to go if you are the winner. To be in the chance of winning those premiere tickets and the hotel stay, answer the following question, please. Kieran Culkin made his big screen debut in what classic Christmas comedy? And a hint if you need it, the film starred his older brother, Macaulay. Answer it please to 51551, or indeed you can WhatsApp us on 087 032 32 0870 32 32 32. 0870 32 32 32. We will announce the winner before the end of tonight's programme. The French may have had the Lumiere brothers, but who were certainly the first to create the moving image. But Youghal in County Cork was the home to a trio of pioneering brothers, the Horgans, who were the Irish Lumieres. Back in the early days of the 20th century, the brothers brought cinema to Youghal in County Cork, but also captured life and culture in Munster at the turn of the century, 19th into 20th. A new T.G. Cahir documentary, Na Lumiere Gaeilge, tells the story, and I'm delighted to have Stuart O'Hur, Monclar Shin, Dorina Clancy, Aaron Glar, Lum, Anocht. Míle Buíochas as Vetling, Erdus, Dorina.
I'm looking forward to it. Míle Buíochas, Sean, come to talk to.
Good morning, Míle Mahagot. Now, let us talk about these brothers. I have to say, I was quite astonished. They, you know, if you were to listen to lots of the Cork people who talk in the documentary, you'd swear that the Lumiere brothers knew nothing about filmmaking. But these guys were extraordinary.
They really were. They really were. And it's just been an honour and a privilege and a lot of fun to bring this to the, you know, to bring this to the screen. I grew up with this story because it's from my hometown. And so I've always known about them.
Yeah.
So for us here, it was you know, it's a no-brainer sort of thing. But for the wider, you know, Irish audience, if not international audience, people don't know that they were doing what they were doing, you know. So it's just been such a privilege to kind of bring people's attention, bring this to people's attention, to be quite honest. You know?
And one of the things that's quite striking is their father died relatively young and they were left practically penniless. But very quickly, they kind of found a way of looking after themselves because the father was cleverer than they expected.
He really was. I mean, that's something that the descendants really, you know, find extraordinary about family is that their mother, Elizabeth, really drove the boys, the three boys, you know. She was left destitute almost, you know, literally a day from the workhouse, so to speak, back at the late 1880s. And they were penniless, but the father, as you say, he was very smart and he had left a little cash cow behind and they finally found it. And she managed to afford to put them into an apprenticeship, which was great, you know.
Yeah, because the father had been a shoemaker and then the three of them became shoemakers. But all along, and I think it was particularly James who had the interest in photography from very early on.
From very early on, they really did. And I mean, it's remarkable that the photograph of their confirmation, because they wouldn't have been allowed into the apprenticeship until they were confirmed and, you know, had their communion, etc. So that communion or confirmation photograph still exists, you know.
And
so
a lovely detail about that photograph in particular was they have the confirmation medal and there was an argument about what side should they put the medal on, you know, because obviously in the photograph it would be reversed and they decided to put them in the middle to get over that row.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It really is just brilliant that that lore has even come through the family, you know what I mean, so that we're able to tell that story. So it's great.
And equally, you can tell the story of, you know, they do get themselves, they're developing their interest, no pun intended, in photography all along the way. And they are qualified shoemakers as well. But was it the mother who would go out the front when a customer came in? She would go out and ask them, which Mr. Horgan are you looking for? Are you looking for the shoemaker or are you looking for the photographer? And what was done?
And depending on who the customer was looking for on Burn Street, she would say, that's no problem, and go back out and get the guys. And if they were looking for the shoemaker, they would arrive out in their, you know, leather aprons. But if it was the photographers, they would come out in their white chemical coats. You know, so it was quite, you know, entertaining in and of itself, really, to be honest. But very proper. Yeah. Very proper, you know.
But they seemed to have almost this sense of theatre about everything they did, not least of
they
which was...
They really, really did. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And that really comes across in the photographs. James in particular, you know, just from the photographs alone, you can see he's a huge involvement in amateur dramatics. He's involved in everything. You know, he's made his own cello. He makes sets. There's another great story that didn't actually make it to the documentary about, you know, sparking the battery of a car to create the shining moon and the set going on fire, you know, that kind of thing. But they really enjoyed every single thing that they did. They had a lot of fun, and I think that's what really makes their photography unique.
One of the things that comes across, obviously, that it was obviously in y'all, but it was worldwide, this interest in technology and how things were growing. Let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary, Cassandra O'Connell here and David Putnam talking about what pioneers those early filmmakers actually were and this kind of things that they had to do.
The moving image was exciting for a number of reasons. It allowed people to see things that they couldn't see in everyday life. Things like the Lumiere brothers famously filmed a train coming into a station. For people to sit in an enclosed space and see this thing coming at them was really thrilling.
There are moments where extraordinary changes take place, where it requires a relatively few number of imaginative, bright people who look at the status quo and say, whoa, you know what? We could do with this, we could change this, we could make it better, we could bring it to more people, we could turn it into a business. So in the UK, you have Michelin Kenyon standing outside churches, standing outside football grounds, standing outside anywhere, factory gates, anywhere a lot of people would gather, filming people, processing that, going back a week later to show the local town themselves on a flickering screen the following Saturday. So what you have is a business model evolving that became what we call exhibition. You know, none of this existed. There was an extraordinary ferment of excitement around inventiveness and what you could do with inventions, what you could do with this new technology that was quite extraordinary and clearly penetrated as far as Cork City, Cork County. And things were going on here which were mind-blowing, actually.
Certainly were mind-blowing. That's David Putnam in a clip there from the documentary we're speaking about, in Na Lumiere Gaeilge. And the director and writer of the programme, Doreena Clancy, is with me on the line this evening. What the brothers were doing, I mean, I was kind of half laughing at, were they ahead of the Lumiere brothers or were they behind the Lumiere brothers? They were already looking. They were interested in photography. That became an interest in film. They had kind of started to develop moving pictures and make moving pictures of the people of y'all and of the surrounding areas. And it's a real social history of the area at the time, Doreena.
There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they were obviously, you know, they had their finger on the pulse, as they would say, you know, and they were going out with the cameras that they could get their hands on. They were adapting their own cameras as well so that they could bring them on their magic lantern tours of the area, you know, to all the little villages around here. But I mean, they were literally standing outside the church, and anywhere there was people, like as David Putnam had said there, anywhere there was people, the Horrigans went there. So if it was a Corpus Christi procession, if it was the St. Patrick's Day parade, or if it was people coming out of the church, or indeed the very first footage of horse racing in Ireland was taken by the Horrigan brothers here in Yall, which is incredible considering Davy Russell is actually from Yall as well. You know?
And the other thing that, if I picked it up correctly, and I'm pretty certain I did, was that they bought a camera from the Lumiere brothers. They bought a projector from the Lumiere brothers and then made a camera from that themselves because the Lumiere brothers were holding on to the cameras. Am I right in thinking that?
That's correct, yeah. They adapted things so well. Like they literally tinkered around with things so that they could actually go out and make their own films and show their own films within their own magic lantern shows.
And then
Go ahead. No, and then they created the Yall Gazette, which was the newsreels that they were bringing into the magic lantern shows as well, and then later on into the cinema.
Yeah, and that would have been one of the first of those type of newsreel things. Absolutely. Internationally, the whole idea. And it was local news. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Great moment that's described in the documentary as well, when King Edward VII and Queen Alexandra come to visit Waterford, and off they go with the camera that they've made from the Lumiere brothers, pieces that they've bought from them. And the camera was odd looking, to say the very least. And the policeman stands in front of them. But let's listen to how that story is told in the documentary itself.
We're in camera at the, so it's Ganzi, for the born on camera. Got knock for you, and it's still this, all right, I could talk. So, because she saw us on camera, show, I guess Phil, then a lava stick, and plus more the doof. I guess for Jim Aguirre, wind also, as I was Tom Aguirre, the lens. And he's got in the guard, they saw us to Captain Kamek Gunnan or Olegni Stigam and Stigsamala.
Agus Hess Sarsant does Napoleoni. Agus the Yultikshe does Na Draharica Yaragon. Ain Green Graff of Hogan. Ain Skanani at the end of. Agus Vi Ankarashti Driven. Driven. Tacnis Congri. Agus Vi and Buyanon. Na Vaidish Ain Green Graff no Ain Victor. Has shames amach, agus legshe an sarsant, agus lenad ar a raig, lishan, scananiacht. Agus teach an riamach, agus higshe loarach, dehenshe gur camra vion, agus dordigshe dos na Paulini, shasav shir.
Agus an bon rian freshen, hug si shinchad fos, agus amal dota cark examla, she smiled graciously into the lens.
Schlachten Shin on Scanon Lumia Gwilica and Dorina Clancy, director of the documentary film, is with me. And that story is wonderful. That, you know, obviously they thought, what are they doing with this contraption? What is it? And the policeman stood in front of it, but the king recognized it, the queen recognized it, and so the pictures were taken. One thing I wanted to really mention, because I think this is hugely innovative. Tell us about the Clockgate animation. And I suppose to do this, you have to boast about one of y'all's great architectural treasures.
There we go. So the Clockgate was the gateway to the town, obviously. And y'all is one of the only towns in the Republic, I believe, with its own town wall still intact. So the Clockgate straddles the main street. And the Horgans used the Clockgate as part of the photography, etc., for many, many years. And you know, we're unsure of this specific date, but it's quite early on in the 1900s, 1910s, and they created the very first the only existing animation in Ireland with the Clockgate making it dance and twirl and do cartwheels all around the town.
Yeah, I know, it is.
Just on the street, it's great.
You know? And you have that footage amazing footage within the documentary itself. I must say, I find it fascinating, Dorina, and I hope people will do so who watch it. Gurumaha gotha svetling enough, Dorina. Dorina Clancy on Shin, the Stúrthóir of na Lumiar Gaeilge. You can see it and hear it on TG Cahir on St. Stephen's Night at 9:10. Folk horror is a genre that's going from strength to strength in fiction and in cinema. Writer Andrew Michael Hurley is one of its quiet stars. He made his name with his debut novel, The Lonely, in 2014, which won the 2015 Costa Book of the Year. Hurley's 2019 novel, Star Vehicle, was adapted for the screen last year in a very well-received film starring Matt Smith. His latest book is Barrow Beck, 13 linked short stories set in a fictional village on the Lancashire-Yorkshire border that gives the collection its name, Barrow Beck, that is. Richard Aldous has been reading the book for us. He joins me on the line this evening. I think it's safe to say, Richard, nobody is going to want to move to Barrow Beck after reading these stories.
No, Sean, this is a pretty bleak place to live. As you say, these 13 stories are all set in this same place over a period of 2,000 years. But kind of constantly in all the stories, you get these phrases like, for example, Barrow Beck wasn't a playground, it was a prison. New people didn't often move to Barrow Beck, or if they did, they didn't stop long. Or one of the best quotes that over the centuries people must have felt, as I did after that long journey down the valley on that filthy, rutted lane, Barrow Beck wasn't worth coming to, and yet some people had spent their entire lives here. It didn't bear thinking about. That really is the essence of much of the storytelling.
And yet what he creates, what Andrew Michael Hurley creates there in terms of the physical geography of the place, I mean, I'm presuming he was standing in and around somewhere on the Lancashire-Yorkshire border and looking around him and recreating this, because the landscapes as described, the places as named, sound incredibly real.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that anybody who's been to the north of England will recognise, in the sense that the landscape feels very familiar. I don't think that anybody living in the north of England would particularly welcome the association that this is a specific place because it's pretty terrible. But, you know, one of the things that he does very skillfully, actually, in this book is that the way in which real life events are woven in. So, you know, for example, the First World War is there, climate change is there. There are all kinds of examples where you look at these stories and you think, yeah, there's a familiarity. And I think one of the things that he does very, very well, and something that I think he probably does in his other work, although this is the first book of his that I've read, is that a bit like Stephen King, he leaves the loose ends there. Mm. And that contributes to this sense of uneasiness, which you have as a reader stuck in this kind of rather bleak, forbidding place.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes when I hear writers saying they like to leave space for the reader, I worry that they're asking too much of the reader, or perhaps that, you know, it's pointing to a flaw within it. But I think from what you're saying, in the case of Andrew Michael Hurley, that is not the case. Those spaces, in fact, are great for the reader.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually one of the things that makes the book so intriguing. I mean, he's an incredibly skillful writer. And so you always have this sense that even though it's kind of very fluid and very easy to read, that he's somebody who has a real technical command of language. So you're exactly right. When he leaves those spaces, he does it on purpose. Yeah. And, you know, quite often in some of these stories, you really don't quite know what's happened. There's one story, for example, where you think a child is about to be murdered, but he doesn't quite tell you what's going to happen. Yeah. And so, of course, as a reader, when you finish that story, we always want closure. And that's something that he doesn't give us. And it's one of the reasons why the stories stick in your mind.
In fact, the children generally don't fare well in these stories, it has to be said. Natural Remedies is one story about a childless couple and then how eventually they have a daughter. And then later on, a fellow called Jason, who's the son of Pastor Keith, a story called An Afternoon of Cake and Lemonade. Again, if you don't want to live there, you certainly don't want to be a child or a young person in this part neck of the woods.
No, absolutely. And that story with Jason is where that quote that Barabek wasn't a playground, it was a prison, comes from. And you're right, children are there all the way through, right from the very first story, actually. Mm. And some of the associations with children are just simply about the hardship. That one early story says that even at Agatha's age, as a child of the valley, she was starting to understand that their life would be one of endless work. So there's a sense of the grind of living there, but then there is also this kind of prevailing sense of malice, of danger, of vulnerability, and children as being the most vulnerable of all in those communities.
The opening story, in fact, is called First Footing, and it's Anglo-Saxon invaders have driven Celtic farmers from their own homes on the Welsh border, and so they settle in Barrowbeck. I wonder to what extent does he give us, like, it spans the ages right through until the current day, I think, or certainly recent times, the entire collection. Is he giving us a kind of a potted social history at different points in time?
Yeah, there is an element of that. As you say, this is 2,000 years worth of history, and actually the final story takes us into the future, where kind of Barrowbeck is, due to environmental reasons, is underwater, the place has completely abandoned. So, you know, we have that full story from the beginning where it's first founded to the very end where there's really nobody living there anymore and the place is literally falling to pieces and, as I say, underwater. And you do get this kind of sense of changing attitudes around things like religion, for example, that God is something that somebody who features all the time in these stories, and our attitudes to religion, to superstition, to these kind of things, social attitudes on questions like marriage, on the relationship between parents and children, on individuals and authority, all of these kind of things ebb and flow through the stories. So yeah, there definitely is this sense of kind of social change being trapped through these stories in this one place. And he's very clever at bringing things back to remind us of earlier bits of the book.
They were all based, they started out as 15-minute radio plays, which were broadcast or certainly written, I think, during lockdown. That sense of dread, that sense of claustrophobia is all over the book, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you can actually tell that this is a lockdown book, because it as you say, it has that sense of claustrophobia, of being stuck somewhere, of being able to see the outside world, but not actually being able to get to it or travel to it, which of course is something that, you know, all of us went through during the pandemic, where we were literally, you know, locked down in one place. So, you know, I think that, again, it's something that has a certain resonance for anybody reading these stories.
One for diehard folk horror fans, would you say, Barrowbeck, or is there a general readership there for it, in your opinion, Richard?
I think there is a general readership. I mean, let's be honest, this is not James Herriot, All Creatures Great and Small. It's a very different north of England, but they are really intriguing. And I have to be honest with you that although I didn't like them, they've stuck with me since I've been reading them, and I suspect that they'll stay in my mind for quite a long time.
All right. Well, that is a recommendation in and of itself, I guess. That is Barrowbeck by Andrew Michael Hurry. Richard Aldous reviewing it for us this evening. The book is published by John Murray. Tonight's competition to go to see the Irish premiere of A Real Pain and an overnight stay in Smithfield. The answer, of course, Kieran Culkin, like his brother Macaulay, was in the film Home Alone. And tonight's winner is Pamela Rogers from Kells in County Meath. Congratulations to you, Pamela. Let me tell you about Monday evening's programme just before I go. Adele Coffey, Jen Gannon, John Maguire, Kane Sullivan will be with me to look back at the cultural highlights of the year. We'll cover film, TV, literature and music. We'll also be looking forward to what is to come in 2025. So that is Monday evening's arena here on RTE Radio 1. But that's our lot for this week, for this Friday night. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Liam Murphy research, Jimmy Doyle was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you on Monday for that best of 2024 and what to look forward to in 2025. John Creedon will be with you after the news.